Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Can I just ask?
Shut up, Evan.
I'm curious.
Could you shut up, Evan?
One thing I was thinking about.
Shut up, Evan.
So there are some rumors out there.
Evan, shut up!
Is it okay if I just ask?
Shut up, Evan.
Okay, but can I just?
Shut up, Evan.
I didn't even say anything. Hi, people. What's up? It's Evan Ross Katz, and you are listening to Shut Up, Evan, a podcast about gay shit and internet culture. I'm Evan Ross Katz, and I'm changing the opening from "Hey guys, what's up?" to "Hey people, what's up?" Because there's just something about when I say it lately where I second guess myself and I'm like, I don't like saying, "Hey, you guys, hey guys." I was, "Hey guys, what's up?" Yeah. I just don't like that as much. I don't know. I can't even really explain it other than to say, I was sitting here brainstorming before of some other thing I could say. I thought about "Hey humans." And then I was like, that's not how I'm going to address you all. And then I was like, "Hey, you all," but that doesn't quite roll off the tongue. "Hey people, what's up? It's Evan Ross Katz, and you're listening to Shut Up, Evan. As I said, a podcast about gay shit and internet culture." I wasn't going to record tonight. I usually sort of schedule these, and I'm feeling a certain kind of way about something. And I just spoke to somebody else who mentioned a similar feeling that they're in. So I decided, you know what, why not talk about the emotion in its most raw state. And that is, I made the dumb decision. I have a Google alert on my name. Maybe some of you can relate to that. Maybe some of you are like, the egomaniac in this person is so off-putting. I do though. I have a Google alert, and I clicked on the Google alert and it brought me to a Reddit thread about my book. And I just spent like half an hour on the couch. I guess you would call this doom scrolling, emphasis on the doom. But also emphasis on the scrolling. I was deep in it. And I just read the meanest things about me and my book. Really mean things. Some with worth. I mean, there was a whole thing pointing out all of the inaccuracies in the book, like just factual errors, you know? And there are quite a few. I'm embarrassed to say there are quite a few. And then there were other comments just about my writing and just, you know, horrible, horrible things. And I couldn't stop looking at it. So then I happened to be texting with a friend, an actor friend of mine, and I complimented a recording of his that I was listening to that happened to come on my Spotify. And he was like, "Oh, thank you so much, Evan. I was just reading some things that people were saying about me on the internet, and I was feeling really down. And this message from you really brightened my day." And I'm like, wow, it must be so strange to have to live in a world in which you can log on and sometimes read these things about yourself. And I used to hear this from actors or, you know, people in Hollywood, people in the entertainment world. And I would always say to them, because I don't know how or why, but I thought I was in some sort of position to say, just don't read the comment section. Because it seems as though there's a problem and there's an easy solution. And we shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't. And this isn't just people that are in the entertainment world. I don't think we should read things that people are saying about us on the internet. But at the same time, it's really hard not to. And I think that does have something to do with the ego, because there is a part of me I'm in the rawest state of this emotion. I'm thinking out loud right now, but I'm like, get rid of the Google alert. But then it's like, I need the Google alert for some things. It's like, you want to be able to filter the kinds of things that you're taking on, because I wish I had not spent that half hour doom scrolling, but I couldn't not, or rather I need to build a practice in which I cannot. That's sort of, I guess, what's becoming illuminated to me right now. But I just wanted to share this to say that I think it's just really easy. Actually, I should speak from my personal perspective. I think I'm someone who throws stones at glass houses sometimes. And I'm having one of those aha moments, which I think led me to get on the mic right now. But anyway, I wish I hadn't read that. Some of it I did find useful. There are some things that I read where I was like, book number two, I would take that advice. I would be more thoughtful about this thing or that thing. So it wasn't a fruitless endeavor. It wasn't a worthwhile endeavor. Maybe there was some worth to it. Who knows? But this to say, I just think being on the internet is strange. It's strange. And I don't hear a lot about it from people, because I think there's, we don't talk about the Fight Club kind of mentality, first rule of Fight Club. We don't talk about the Fight Club, but I don't know. I felt something, and it was interesting to hear somebody else's experience and think about it from the perspective of how I used to hear that. And now that I'm a little bit feeling it, I think I have a different perspective on it. Funny how that happens, isn't it? Anyway. Sometimes you just need to take a deep breath. But this is me. This is how I get sometimes when I'm feeling a certain way about something. And I decided to finally close out and express how I feel with the hope that I will get off the microphone right now and I will take a deep breath. I will not log back into that. And I will try and find other things to put in my mind. Maybe I'll read something. Anywho, thank you all for hearing me out on this. I'm so excited for today because I'm obviously been a big fan of this person for a long time, but I've actually really enjoyed getting to know this person. And a funny thing about our guest, who, let's just reveal it now, Cynthia Erivo is our guest today. And Cynthia is someone who, her and I sort of developed this voice memo friendship. And there was one instance, I think it was backstage during the Oscars, I want to say, several seasons ago. And I loved Cynthia's dress so much that I messaged her asking her a question about it for a paper story that I was doing. And Cynthia's just like casually backstage at the Oscars, sending me a voice memo about her dress. I was able to then use that quote for my paper magazine story, because that's just how she does things. She just gets stuff done. She really does. And I really admire that. Anyway, it was such a thrill talking to her, and super duper cool to have a friend of hers and a new friend of mine call in to get in on the conversation. That's one thing about the podcast that I really enjoy is in addition to the guests, getting to talk to some other folks and sort of brainstorm questions with them for the guest. So without any further ado, I guess I blew my load early by saying, but let's throw to the great Cynthia Erivo. Shut up, Evan. She is an Emmy, Grammy, and Tony Award winner, as well as a two-time Academy Award nominee. And lest we not leave out her two Golden Globe nominations and two Screen Actors Guild nominations. She earned acclaim for her portrayal of Celie in the 2013 Meunier Chocolate Factory production of The Color Purple, and went on to win a Tony Award for the role when the show was revived on Broadway in 2015. Her other stage credits include Rosemary and How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, Puck in A Midsummer Night's Dream, and Kathy in The Last 5 Years. She made her on-screen debut in Steve McQueen's Widows and went on to star in Drew Goddard's acclaimed Bad Times at the El Royale. She is perhaps best known for portraying Harriet Tubman in her Academy Award-nominated turn in Harriet. She was also nominated for Best Original Song that year at the ceremony. She most recently appeared on screen in the film Needle in a Time Stack and is currently in production on 3 films, the crime drama Luther, Robert Zemeckis' reimagining of Pinocchio, and the highly anticipated film adaptation of the Tony Award-winning musical Wicked, in which she'll portray Alphaba opposite Ariana Grande as Glinda. Her television credits include Chewing Gum, Broad City, and RuPaul's Drag Race. She earned an Emmy and Golden Globe nomination for her turn as Aretha Franklin in Genius Aretha, and will next star in the Apple Plus TV series Roar opposite AMC Theaters enthusiast Nicole Kidman. She released her debut album, Chapter One, Verse One, in September of 2021, which featured the lead single, The Good. I highly encourage you to go ahead and stream it. All this to say, she is quite an accomplished and decorated entertainer. To know her is to love her, and I could not be more delighted to welcome the wickedly talented, see what I did there, Cynthia Erivo.
Shut up, Evan.
Before we begin, I just have to express some gratitude. I am extremely elated. I know your schedule is busy, and it means so much to me that you would make the time to be here.
I would not have been anywhere else. I saw it and I was like, yeah, I'm doing it for sure. You know, I love it.
I love to hear it. And I just want to say, in preparation for today, I revisited much of your work and I rewatched Widows, your 2018 Steve McQueen film debut. And I just want to say, for those out there that missed this movie, first of all, shame on you. But anyone out there listening, please go and watch this movie. Your performance, I forgot how effing good you are. And so I just had to tell you off the bat, Widows, must-see filmaking.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I want to start by asking about your running journey, which you post about regularly on Instagram and inspire me and others each and every day. You, like me, have run the New York City Marathon before, but you, unlike me, pre-gamed for the 2021 Emmy Awards by running a half marathon, which is something I cannot relate to. What has running given you beyond the physical?
I think it gives me a space to sort of meditate in. I didn't expect it to do that. At first, it really was like a fitness journey type thing. But soon I realized that when I ran, I couldn't really be on my phone. I couldn't really, it was sort of like a solo experience for me. And that's sort of what I would use to sort of process the day or think about things, concentrate on how I was feeling internally and externally. And so I think it preps me because it doesn't just prep my body, it preps my mind as well, which is probably why that's sort of what's where I am right now, which is why going and doing a half marathon before the Emmys is sort of like what I needed to sort of release some energy and like be present when I got there. Yeah.
I think there's something about that not having access to the phone bit, because I'm someone who I'm on my phone often, perhaps too often. And the thing about running that I love so much is that there's just, you do not have the capability to do both at once. So it sort of forces you to look up and interact with the world around
you. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, it's funny because I was on a run and my producing partner called me and she said, well, there's this meeting that's, we probably need to do it now. I was like, well, I'm running, so I actually can't speak. So I don't know how this can work. And so everyone knows that when I'm running this, you have to just leave me alone and I'll get back to everybody as soon as I come back. It's sort of like my time for me. Yeah.
Which is important to have. A big subject on this podcast has been the HBO Max series And Just Like That. I believe that you, like me, and like many, were watching And Just Like That. And without making this a full And Just Like That podcast, I'm wondering if you can give me top level, any thoughts you had on the series. What did you love? Are you too clamoring for a season two? And what is your overall on Che Diaz?
Okay, I definitely want a season two. I loved seeing a character like Che Diaz in this new space that these women are in, because it sort of brings us into the now. We get to experience different types of people. And I think Che was really cool. I don't know, there was something that was kind of like charming about Che. And I loved Che for Miranda. And I think that for me, the most wonderful moment probably is that moment in Carrie's house, where it's when she's just woken up, and obviously she's been up, and we know the moment. And she's witnessed it, and she's been privy to it, she's heard everything. But then she and Miranda have this incredible heart to heart, and Cynthia Nixon is incredible, but you just bears her soul. She's, you know, to be able to be an honest enough to say, I'm unhappy in where I am right now and I need something more. I need something different. I thought it was a really, really special moment. And I hope that other women would watch that and see that it's okay to admit that the thing that you're in right now might not be the thing that's working for you. Anybody in those situations can admit that that whatever they're in right now is not working and they need more. And I just thought it was a really beautiful moment.
I am completely aligned with you. That is writer Samantha Irby that wrote episode 5 of the series, which is definitely my favorite. Yeah, I mean, hats off to her and everyone involved. Let me ask you this. For so many people, Sex and the City was that show that sort of taught them so much about, you know, gave them a broader sense of a worldview, or just was the first thing that they really fell in love with. Was there a movie or television show for you in your formative years was like that?
A movie? Is it strange to mention Devil Wears Prada? Devil Wears Prada was really, for me, for some reason, was one of those, it's one of those movies that I keep going back to. Probably because I was sort of discovering my love for fashion and the world of it. And I just, like that, the opening credits of it with the song, "This Guy is a Beautiful World in a Beautiful World." And she walks through and the outfits keep changing and it just is so brilliant. I don't know, it just gave me sort of like a deeper understanding of what that world could be like, not just the thing that we think it is, but also the love of it and what people will do when they're in love with fashion, how far people will go. And which is probably why I'm the way I am right now and why I pick things I pick. And I think that was one of those pieces. The Color Purple was one of those films that I think changed my life just because I'd never seen anyone look like me on screen like that before. Whoopi is sort of like the touchstone, and to see her in such vulnerability and performing in such a beautiful way and so quiet and so subtle. And I just thought, it's one of those things that sort of taught me what I know and how I am now. A TV show. I don't know if there was a TV show particularly. I watched all sorts. For me, I think it might be Buffy, because Buffy and Angel I watched all the time, every single episode. I had the box sets and all of those things. It's just something about a woman with not just physical strength, but vulnerability and the strength of her friends and all of that coming together. I think that just was really, really cool. There was something about it, yeah.
I love this combination of The Devil Wears Prada, The Color Purple, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I think, like, what could be a more perfect answer? Let's talk about The Color Purple, because what makes this film so great is that it has this legacy. And then on top of that, it has this fantastic musical of which you are a part of. And recently it was announced that we're getting a film adaptation of the musical, which is just so excited. How do you feel to see the legacy of this movie and this musical be carried forward once more?
I think it's wonderful. I think the idea that this piece of art keeps being reborn over and over again is really special, and that another set of people get to experience how joyous it can be, and that another set of people can experience the gift that it is. And for me, I always say that it's the gift that keeps on giving, because I don't think it's ever stopped changing my life. And so I think I'm very excited to see it. I'm very excited to see everyone in it. I can't wait to see Fantasia take it up again and be Seely. And I think that it can be really, really special. So I think it's a wonderful thing that this keeps continuing. If there's something about this that, you know, doesn't rest, it's wonderful.
And what's so wonderful too is for many of us that saw the production on Broadway or on tour, to be able to revisit it once more. I mean, obviously we have these soundtracks from the original production, the revival, to keep us satiated, but it's just so exciting to have the opportunity to share this musical with the world, because that's one of the great things that a film adaptation affords. Now, I had the grand opportunity to witness your visionary performance as Seely in The Color Purple during your Tony Award-winning run in 2016, a role which you first originated in London in 2013. I want to zero in on your number, I'm Here, which closes Act 2 of the show. For me, it's one of the finest displays of the power of the musical art form, and one you were able to deliver 8 shows a week. And I'm wondering if you could describe the feeling of taking that song, building it within yourself, and then releasing it each night. I would love to have you expound on this moment, which I really think crystallizes Celie's journey.
Yeah, I mean, that particular song really is it's sort of like the culmination of the things that she's been through, has had to learn to get to that moment of self-realization, because it isn't enough for her to have left Mister. It isn't enough for her to know that she can make it on her own. It isn't enough for her to have fallen in love with Suge and to have found love. That isn't enough because essentially she's moving from one person to another and hasn't, when she moves in with Suge and when she leaves with Suge, she hasn't found the strength to be her own person yet. When you get to the song, I'm Here, you have to have found the space within you to understand that everything you need is already there within you, with or without someone, and that the love of self is more important than the love of everybody else. When you can love yourself the most, then you have the capacity to love everyone as fully as you want to. And I think that's what I'm Here is about. By the time I got to that song, rightfully so, you're exhausted. And that's how it's supposed to be. There's nothing else you can give except for that song. The release of it was always ground shaking for me. It was always, I always had to earn the moment. The last words of the song are, I'm beautiful and I'm here. I had to earn it. I had to work through the song to get to those last words and mean it. Yeah. Mm.
What was it like for you at the end of that number? Because, you know, you're talking about earning it. And by the end of the number, you have earned it. And I'm just wondering what it feels like on the other side. And then to have that experience 8 times a week, like you're have this grand catharsis and then you do it over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, the word sunshine came to my mind when you said, what does it feel like on the other side of it? That's what it feels like. It feels like you sort of let go of everything. Because up until that point, you're sort of like, there's a tension that doesn't really leave you up until that point. And then when you get to sort of proclaim those words, everything sort of falls off. And strangely enough, within our production, that's what happened with the set design. Like the light, it got lighter and brighter, but not just in one spot, but like all across the stage became a little brighter, and it felt, you feel lighter. And that's how I felt. It felt like the sunshine had come out and I felt lighter. And to do it over and over again, you have to go through the entire show to get to that point. But there is always the knowledge that sunshine's coming, you know, which is really wonderful.
We're talking about theater. You work in theater, film, and television. And one of the unique things that theater affords is the opportunity for fans of a production to go to a stage door and have a moment with an actor that moved them in a certain way. And maybe it's an autograph, maybe it's just a hi, hello. And I'm wondering what that's like for you as a performer to get to see the faces, maybe shake the hands of, take a photo with the people and hear from them. Because that's something that film and television doesn't afford.
There's something really special about being able to see the people who have been there for the last 2 hours with you, sitting and watching. And at this particular show, everyone just became really open by the end of this show. And so when you would meet people at the end, people would want to speak to you and tell you about their stories and tell you how they relate to Celie and how they relate to whichever other character and how they felt about her and how they feel the strength because she's gained the strength to do something that they've been scared of doing. And I had so many stories and so many people trusting me with their stories that I came to see it as something that was really special and something that was, it's a gift to be able to experience that with people, especially if at a show like this. People want to share their stories and they want to confide in you if they're experiencing things. And I still have it today. People who have been to that show and they saw me in it and they were experiencing something at the time. And if we didn't meet, they meet me now and they still tell me the story of what they experienced that day and or were experiencing in that during that time. It's really special. It's really special.
I agree. Yeah. I think there's something about being seen by the people that you saw that just changes you. I was the kid that stage doored musicals all the time. And to have those interactions, it was so meaningful. It was like life affirming. Let's go back to young Cynthia. I'm wondering how you would describe your younger self.
Determined. I'd say she was clever, creative, inquisitive, curious. Probably less outgoing than I am right now. I think I was a little shyer than I am now, but disappeared quickly. I like the little Cynthia. I like younger Cynthia, but she had to learn how to be confident. You know, she got a couple knocks here and there, but she's pretty brave. She made it this far. Yeah. Mm.
What was your favorite part about school growing up?
Learning and reading books were my favorite thing. I don't know, there was something, you know, when before drama came along and before acting came along, for me it was books, reading and imagining and stories. I'm the kid that was, you know, I got my book at school and I would read it, and I would read it on the train and I would read it on the way home, and I would get into the house and I would take my shoes and I would read the book when I got through the door. That was me. I loved reading and writing. I loved storytelling and stories and all of that, creative writing, literature, and for me, that was sort of my outlet, that and music. And that was the thing that I loved the most about school. And when I was at high school, which would be secondary school for us, I was in the band, or we had a little orchestra. So I was in the orchestra and we were playing music, and learning the semantics of music and the theory of music was really, really fun as well. Those were my touchstones, yeah.
Before we continue, let's take a break and check in with today's sponsors. I want to take a moment to tell you about a product that I first discovered last year and has quickly become a staple in my daily routine. It's called Sniff. Anyone that knows me knows that I'm big on smelling good, but finding a signature scent can be difficult. Enter Sniff, a genderless and cruelty-free line of scents made with high-quality ingredients designed to perform with staying power. They offer a wide range of scents for all genders and all occasions. How to find the right scent? I don't know about you, but I've become accustomed to doing just about everything from the couch, so I'm big on Sniff's try before you buy kits, which allow you to test drive a scent before fully committing. Every purchase comes with a full-size bottle and a mini sample bottle, the latter of which is perfect for travel. Keep and pay for what you love, return the rest with free shipping and returns. And since I want you to be fully in on what's what, I highly recommend the brand's Sweet Ash scent. It's a silky blend of moss, woods, and fir balsam, balanced by hints of tonka and black vanilla bean. In addition to fragrance, Sniff also offers a line of candles, of which the Instant Karma is my personal fave. The lovely folks at Sniff are offering Shut Up Evan listeners 20% off your order with the code EVAN20. All of Sniff's fragrances, including Sweet Ash, are typically $65, but with our special offer code, Evan20, you can get it now for $52. Visit sniff.co, that's SNIF.co, and enter promo code Evan20 at checkout. What are you waiting for? And we're back. So a two-parter, when did you first discover and fall in love with musical theater?
Yes.
And when did you realize that you had something significant to contribute to the art form?
I realized that I loved musical theater when I was in high school. I think I was about 16, and we did a production of Bugsy Malone. I think it was Bugsy Malone first. And I auditioned, but I didn't get the role that I had auditioned for. There's a character called KG Joe in it, who's like the boxing coach. And another girl got Fizzy, who sings the song Tomorrow. There's a song called Tomorrow in it. It's very good. And she wasn't well the day of, or like the week leading up, and she wasn't going to make the show. So they gave me that role. So I ended up playing both of those roles. And I remember feeling completely invincible. So I had learned those two roles and it just sort of felt right. And then the year after that, I think because of what I had done that previous year, they did My Fair Lady and I played Eliza. And I don't know what it was about this particular show. Something about it taught me that this was definitely part of my future. It was something I could do really well. And I felt really good when I was doing it. I felt like I was in a completely different world. So that was the first time I knew this is probably where I might be.
And thank God for that. I mentioned to you that I had a surprise for you. I have friends or fans of the guests that I have on often call in with a question. And we're talking about musical theater right now. So I wanted to bring in a friend and an upcoming colleague of yours.
Hi, Cynthia. It's Ariana. I was very excited when Evan asked me to surprise you with a question for his amazing podcast. And I was realizing I don't think I've ever asked you this. What are your favorite musicals? What are your top three favorite musicals? And I love you very much. Okay, bye. Speak soon in like 30 seconds. Okay, bye. Also, love you, Evan. Thank you for having me briefly.
I love her so much. I love her so much. I love her so much.
So your three favorite musicals. And I have to say, I too am deeply curious to know.
Three favorite musicals. Okay. I think it would be wrong of me to not say The Color Purple, because it really did change my life and it's nothing like I've ever experienced before. And the music is incredible. Oh, this is hard. Three only. This is hard, Evan.
I know.
Because I have like six and I'm like, these are the musicals that I go back to.
Okay. If you want to give a couple, we can expand the category.
Okay. So The Color Purple. I love Thoroughly Modern Millie.
Love
Thoroughly Modern Millie. It's one of my favorites.
Cheryl Lee Ralph. Come on now.
Come on. Rocky Horror Show is brilliant. Again, it's very cult classic-y. So, okay, those are the cult classics. I really do love Wicked. Do you know that I took myself to see Wicked on my 25th birthday? I went by myself. I bought tickets and I went to see Wicked on my 25th birthday, totally alone.
I get it.
That was myself. So it is one of my favorites and I can't believe I'm doing it. I can't even believe it. And Last 5 Years is one of my favorites.
Absolutely.
And it is a toss up between, because we could go really classic here and say like A Sound of Music or a Mary Poppins. Mm-hmm. Or I can take you right back to like a Debbie Allen. All right, I'm going to say Polly. There's a musical called Polly based on called Pollyanna. And Debbie Allen was the director of the film. It is straight to TV. It's like a TV musical and you can get the VHS. That like, if you haven't seen the musical, please see it. It's so beautiful and brilliant. So that's one of my favorites. Or I can go really sort of modern and, because when I saw Dear Evan Hansen, I was bawling and I saw Ben do it. And that's really how we became good friends, because he was across the street from me. He was at the Music Box and I was at the Jacobs and we would just meet each other at lunch and just chill and all sit in silence and eat some food and then sleep and then go back to our shows. Okay, we'll go Color Purple, Thoroughly Modern Millie, Rocky Horror Show. Ooh, but then because it's Tim, isn't it? It's like it's Rocky Horror Show or Annie. Him in either one, you know.
Yeah.
I'm gonna do a twofer on that one and say it's the Rocky Horror Show and Annie, because those two musicals are brilliant, right? But he is brilliant in both of them. Okay. We're gonna say Polly, because it is a classic and gorgeous. And we're going to say, am I neglecting The Lion King though? Am I?
Not no.
I'm going to say Dear Evan Hansen. I am going to say Dear Evan Hansen. And I'm going to throw in an extra that's not necessarily the entire musical, but I will throw in a section of Hamilton. And that particular section is Wait for It, when it's Aaron Burr, otherwise, well, Leslie Odom Jr. singing Wait For It in Hamilton. It is one of the most thrilling moments I've ever seen in my entire life. That aside, that combined with In the Room Where It Happens, him singing those two songs, just unbelievable. Just unbelievable.
I love the breadth
now,
of that
wait
answer.
A minute. Wait a minute. Oh. Now. Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. What I was just reminded of as I was speaking of singular moments is Audra McDonald doing Billie Holiday at the Emerson Bar and Grill. Unbelievable. So I will do, I'll say that. I'll stop there. That's what I'll give.
I love that. I want to say I have recently been on a Thoroughly Modern Millie revisit. And again, I just want to say Cheryl Lee Ralph's performance of the song Only in New York is so spectacular. Every note, her voice, it's like, it just settles your stomach. It just makes you it's delightful. It's just, yeah, I love that. Cause it's like, you know, you always want to go to the big, Sutton's big numbers, which are great, but the whole score from that show and Harriet Harris. Yes, we could go on and on. I know you can't say too much about the film, but if you'll indulge me, what are you most excited about in bringing this? I think calling it eagerly anticipated is an understatement. What are you most excited about bringing this and highly anticipated film to life at long last?
I think being able to work, and this might sound facetious, but it's really not. I think I'm really excited about working with Ariana. We've had a lot of conversations, we've been talking and we've spent time together. And I think she is just as passionate about this, if not more, as I am. And I think both of us want to make sure that people both see the stories of these two women who have this incredible friendship and both want good in the world. And I don't know, I just think that there's so much of the world that we get to show, because we get to put it on film, we get to expand what people believe Oz can be and is. And John, who our director, is very excited about creating this world and creating these new versions that we might not have thought of through myself and Ariana. And I can't wait. I'm really excited to really learn it, to learn the new script, to learn the music properly, to like get my teeth into all of it. And I'm just excited. I think auditioning for it was incredible. I threw myself into this audition so much so that by the end of it, I was ill for 4 days, like just in bed, unable to move. I got to my door and a fever hit. It was so peculiar, but I think that that's what you're gonna expect from us. We're throwing ourselves into it completely. And I think it's gonna be really special, really special.
So is it fair to say that your fever waited until after the audition was done? So like get you through it, power you through, and then it was like, okay, it's over. Okay, now the fever can set in.
Literally what happened. Mm. Because just before I had gone, I felt something, then nothing. Then it went away and I was fine. We did the audition. I like threw everything into it, just did as much as I possibly, like I felt like I was unloading whatever I had like built up inside me to do this thing. I got to my door and just ill, just unwell, and basically crawled into bed, and I knocked out for like 4 days.
I'm wondering if you've been thinking at all about the riffs of the show, because one thing that Wicked superfans like myself are familiar with is that every Elphaba and some Glinda's too come in with their own interpretation on so many of those delightful moments within the score, not just talking to Fine Gravity. I mean, there's 100 versions of No Good Deed, for instance. I like to listen to each and every single one. Have you been thinking about your riffs at all?
Kind of. What I did was I went back to the original. I went back to Idina. I went back to the beginnings of it because that's where I sort of can build from. And I tend to let the riffs happen naturally. So if a riff comes in the right place and it feels like it's right and it's purposeful, then it will happen. And if it sticks and we feel like it's right, then it will stay there. I've just been thinking about how to really sort of tell the stories through the songs. And sometimes that means that a riff is necessary here. Sometimes it means I might take away a riff.
Mm. Do you have a favorite song in the show?
It keeps changing. So I'm Not That Girl was a favorite. Then I sort of jumped. No Good Deed was my very favorite at the beginning. The Wizard and I, like that, I don't know, there's just something really endearing about that song, the storytelling in it, the it's like it works in chapters, which I think is really, it's a special song in that way, in that you can really go from the beginning, you get to the middle, and you get to the end, and it's just a lovely way to tell a story. That's really, I think it's one of my, and then obviously For Good. For Good always sort of like comes right, I always end up coming back to For Good.
One thing I really love about No Good Deed is I don't think there's a lot of songs like it in the canon of musical theater. And I kind of like that, you know, we talk about things like the I Want song or the 11 o'clock number. There are certain staples within a musical often, and No Good Deed does not fit into the framework of the musical template as it exists so often.
Yeah, I think because it's sort of like the anti 11 o'clock number. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah.
And it, but it, I love that it's sort of in the minor keys. I love that it feels a little darker, but it still has like the breadth and the width. Like it's got the size that you want when it comes to a song, but it still has this sort of like darkness in it. And it's really great. I love, it's a great song to sing. Feels good to sing.
Can't wait to hear you sing it. Last thing I'll say on the subject is that I'm incredibly excited to potentially get our first studio recording of the song, The Wicked Witch of the East. It's the only song in the musical that's not on the original Broadway cast album because it reveals a plot point within the musical that I think now that we're talking so many years in, I think we are safe to potentially get it on the soundtrack. And so I'm very excited about that possibility.
Okay. All right. Good.
Can't get enough of Shut Up, Evan? I don't blame you. That's why you have to check out our Patreon. It's patreon.com/ShutUpEvan, where you will be able to find advanced access to interviews, bonus episodes, video clips from the interviews, cut for time questions, and so much more. You don't want to miss out. I am fully committing to making the Patreon a much more robust experience for season 3. So again, www.patreon.com/ShutUpEvan.
I was listening to an interview that Kirsten Dunst gave on the Awards Chatter podcast, and she spoke about her collaborations with director Sofia Coppola, particularly during the Virgin Suicides, and the way in which Coppola gave Dunst a confidence and a sense of comfort. She mentions one scene in particular when the script called for her to kiss a bunch of boys and she didn't feel comfortable and went to Coppola, who told her that she could just bury her face in their necks and they'd shoot it from behind. I was reminded of a Vanity Fair interview that you did with your friend and collaborator, Michaela Cole, and you talk about a similar sense of comfort. And I wanted to know, how does having that comfort inform the process of creating work? I don't think it's a coincidence that in both of these cases, you are two actresses working with a female director that is of a similar age.
Yeah, I think that the comfort allows you to feel safe. And when you feel safe, you know that you're not going to be taken advantage of. And when you know that you're not going to get taken advantage of, there's sort of like, you can let go even more. So you can give more of yourself because you know that it will never go too far. And I think that that is what we speak of when it's sort of, you want a comfortability with your director. With Michaela, I just knew that she would take care of me. And same with Casey, when we were doing Harriet, we were so in lockstep that she understood what was necessary, what was needed. And those times when it got really hard, she was right there with me. So I knew that she was experiencing it at the same time. And it's not that we want it to be easy at all, and it's not necessarily that we want it to be comfortable and, you know, no hard work. It's just that if you have a level of understanding and comfort between you and your director, you know that you're being watched over, you know that you're being taken care of, and you know that you're safe so that you can do your work and know that you won't hurt yourself mentally or physically. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, that's incredibly poignant. I really think a lot about the importance of comfort, not just for actors, but in general, and sort of what that does to change one's possibility of what they can do in a workspace when they have something like comfort present. You incredibly generously gave an interview to me for my book, Into Every Generation, A Slayer Is Born. And I wanted to know something that you and I talked about in our previous interview that I wanted to bring onto the pod was the character of Kendra, who is a vampire slayer introduced in season 2, played by Bianca Lawson. And I'm just wondering what it was like for you as a young Black girl to see a young Black slayer represented on this television show that I know for both you and I was a really important show in our formative years.
I was so excited. I was so excited to see her. I just didn't see that many images like that on TV. And because I was the weird kid that like wanted to be a Slayer and wanted to do action and wanted to be in those kinds of roles, it was very rare that you would find another woman that looks like you or feels like you on screen doing something like that. So to see Bianca Lawson come in and play this very strong, very cool, very competent Slayer was really, really exciting. And I wish we'd have seen more of her. I wish there was more of Kendra. Yeah.
You and me both. Let's talk fashion. You are a fashion icon, and it's not just the looks, it's how you wear them. It's your awareness and regard for the fantasy that fashion creates, the worlds it allows us to dream about. You give us so much through your fashions, and I'm wondering, what does fashion give you?
A space to be creative. I think sometimes people overthink it and get really safe, and I just want to have fun. I want people to want to talk about the piece you're wearing. I want people to want to have conversation. I want, when you pass by someone in something, that for them to go, oh my goodness, what, like, why did you choose this? And this is, look at that color. And oh my gosh, it makes me smile. And I think that fashion is a way to evoke emotion, not just to look nice. And I think that if you can evoke emotion in someone simply by what you're wearing, then I think you're doing the right thing. And I think that's what I want. I pick the pieces based on how they make me feel, and hopefully they make other people feel something too.
You have a favorite red carpet moment. For me, I always come back to your neon Valentino haute couture from the Golden Globes. I just think it is such a striking image, and you absolutely served it up. But I'm wondering what some of your faves are.
The neon is definitely one of my favorites. We were doing, I think it was the Governor's Ball for the Oscars, and I wore, it was like just layers and layers of dark green chiffon, and I have green glasses and green hair, and the whole thing is just flowy and green, and that's one of my favorite moments. I loved it. And actually recently, the long racerback white leather Louis Vuitton dress with the ruffles at the bottom, feathers at the bottom with the blue and the green and the white. I just felt like $1 million in that. I felt badass and I felt sexy and I felt really good in that piece. So those are my favorites so far. And they sometimes change. Sometimes it, you know, shifts from, you know, from things that I'll re-remember things and I'm like, oh, I really love that. Like the gold column dress that I wore to perform at the Oscars, one of my favorites by Vera Wang, and my Oscar dress, which was by Versace. So yeah, those are my favorites.
What do you like to wear when you're just around the house or in rehearsal or not in sort of, you know, some big public setting?
This is what I wear. This is like a skirt piece by Marcus Almeida. I depends on how I'm feeling on the day. Sometimes I want to dress up and be kind of cool. If I'm wearing sweats, then they're sort of like matching. I'll put the shoes with it and sneakers with it, or I'll put a boot with it. When I go to rehearsals, I'll probably wear some really cool sports bits and pieces. And I don't know, I just like mixing it up, my sort of away from the carpet wardrobe is very, very varied, very colorful. I don't tend to wear a lot of black at all. And I just sort of have fun, even when I'm at home. It tends to be with a pair of spectacles. When I'm not on the red carpet, I'll find any pair of spectacles to match everything I'm wearing. I have all colors. Wow. And all the time.
Love a ring. You know, we're talking about the glamour of the red carpet, but I want to ask you another component of the industry that you're in, and that is the press tour, of which you've been on many at this point. And I don't think people often realize the monotony of the press tour. And I think part of the reason why Gaga's 99 people in a room clip went so viral was seeing her deploy something that I think many actors probably do out of self-preservation, which is just, you start to get asked the same question ad nauseum. And so you start to give the same answer. I'm wondering what it's like for you, or what you can illuminate about that process when you've a camera up in front of you and you kind of have to be on. And yet I imagine there comes a point when you've been asked every question you can be about a particular project, but you have to, you know, put this veneer on of first time you've ever heard it.
Yeah, I mean, it can be exhausting, but I think what I tend to do is try and find something interesting about the person in front of me so that we can end up, so instead of having them ask the same question that they maybe the last person asked me, I'll find something that we can talk about, we can have a conversation about. And that way I don't end up answering the same thing over and over again, or I challenge myself to find a different way to answer the same question. If one, and 9 times out of 10, the person who came into the room like 10 minutes ago and the next person that came in after them, they will ask the same question. And so my brain goes, well, I answered that question, so I'm gonna ask, maybe I'll answer it in a different way. Maybe I'll find something else different to say, or I'll explain something else. But otherwise, you just end up feeling like you're on a sort of merry-go-round that just doesn't ever stop. And I want to have fun during those things. I want to enjoy it just as much as everybody else. That's why, you know, even like when you're walking out on the red carpet, some people hate getting their picture taken. Some people hate doing the red carpet. I really enjoy it because I've gotten to know a lot of the photographers, and they know some of my quirks, and they'll ask for certain things, and it'll be like a nice little group situation. I can have conversations with them, throw comments over there, and that way it doesn't feel like the same thing that we've done over and over again, especially when you're doing the press, you'll see the same faces. So if you remember those faces, then it stops being like, you're taking photos of me and I'm going to go, or we're having the same conversation and I'm going to, it starts to become a relationship, and we get to have fun that way.
It's so interesting you say that. Yeah. Like, it's the symbiosis. I've been doing, you know, a round of press for my book, and I'm suddenly being asked questions about myself for the first time. And I'm so uninterested in talking about myself, but I deflect so often, and I'm like, I'll ask the question back or something. And it kind of reminds me of what you're saying, which is that, like, you know, the photographer wants to take a photo of you, but you reach a point where you're like, well, you want to see the photographer and have an interaction with them and make it so it's not all about you, but rather about each other.
Right. Exactly.
So you are a public figure in a media landscape that craves knowing anything and everything about our stars. For instance, people love to speculate about your romantic life, and I'm wondering how you contend with creating the necessary barriers.
I guess I make the decision about what I want to share and how I want to share it, and if I want to share it at all. I think we're in a business where we're sort of made to think that we have to share everything, but actually, just as human beings in real life, we don't share everything with everybody because not everything is for everybody. And so I try to lead with grace. And if there is a question that I'm asked that I don't feel quite comfortable about answering, I'll just say, you know, it's for me to know and you to maybe never find out, but then that's okay. You know, it's just, I think that it's okay for us to not share everything, because otherwise we'd have nothing to keep for ourselves. And I think everyone's sanity is really important. And so if I can get to keep a couple of the things that I love to myself, I know that I can stay a little sane and I can still be able to share as much as I possibly can. And I love sharing, but I know that there are also things that I want to keep for myself, and that's okay. And I think that when we lose the guilt of not having to share everything, we'll be okay.
Talk to me about your relationship with social media. I mean, I think one of the great things, and this is tied to the question I just asked, is that public figures are afforded more autonomy in crafting their own stories. It doesn't mean that there's not still the same media landscape that likes to take a pull quote and make a splashy headline, but it allows for you to give your fans access to your world on your terms. And I'm wondering what that sort of autonomy, what that does for you, and is there a freedom in that, in being able to be in control of the narrative that you're putting out?
I think so. I think I have a lot of fun with, I'm really only on Instagram and TikTok, and that's kind of it. I sort of share the things that make me happy. Even in my stories, you'll find I'll share the things that I'm interested in, things that make me happy, things that make me laugh, things that make me smile, talents that I really that I'm leaning towards, people that I've seen that I'm interested in, and that way you sort of like get a viewpoint of my mindset and what I'm thinking, and I sort of get to let people in to a point. And obviously there are things that you might not know, but you know enough to know who I am. And I think that that's the wonderful thing about social media. You can sort of share who you are and how you feel about things without someone painting an opinion on you, which I think is kind of refreshing.
Now, one of your unique aesthetic choices within your Instagram reshares is that you will shift the image around so that it's not center on the screen. And I'm just curious about sort of like, I love that because I think it just, I know I'm in your stories when I start to see the image, you know, a little off center. Yeah. Can you tell me about that aesthetic choice?
I just like it. I like seeing it like that. And I've been doing it for a while just because it makes me happy. And like, I'll take something and I'll put it in the corner and I'll remember, oh, well, I put that in the corner, so I'm going to move it over here, because it will keep your eye going, oh, this is interesting. And I think that it's a nice sort of like brain wake up. I think,
I totally agree. I often think about, I don't know who told me this when I was younger, but someone instilled this idea where it's like every moment is an opportunity to inform people more about your point of view, you know, in how you see the world. So it's not just what you share, but what you're adding to that is how you share it. And so I just think it's a small detail, but it's one that, again, like I said, I always know I'm in your stories because you have a
unique
footprint. Of course.
Because I really have, like, I really do put the effort into like how I present each story. So it is, you'll notice that they are never, ever like just straight linear. But ever. Thank you for noticing that. That's really cool.
Of course. Does Cynthia Erivo have a close friends list?
It's a very small close friends list. Yes, but I feel like I made it by accident and I should probably go into it and check who's there and like add or take away. I think I did it by accident.
I tried making one at one point and it just felt so time consuming. It's already time consuming enough, you know, reposting things. And then I was like, and then to add this added layer of like, you know, this gatekeeping to it all, I just was like, this, it just feels too complicated.
I see it comes up, but I'm like, I don't know who's in that list or if I did that. Like, I don't remember doing it. So I feel like I maybe press a button and it said add to close friends and it was a total accident because I don't ever use it.
Before we continue, let's take a quick break and hear from some of our sponsors. Can we talk about Sunday Riley? Not only is it the name of not one, but two of my favorite Buffy the Vampire Slayer characters, it also just so happens to be one of my favorite skincare brands. Sunday Riley uses advanced, clinically proven ingredients blended with balancing botanicals for non-irritating, fast-acting formulas. Just because the end of times might be near doesn't mean you can't have great skin. Some of my current obsessions include their global best-selling Good Genes All-in-One Lactic Acid Treatment, CEO 15% Vitamin C Brightening Serum, and their Autocorrect Brightening and Depuffing Eye Contour Cream. As a person with notoriously puffy eyes, the last one is a really saving grace. If you want to visibly improve the look and feel of your skin, look no further than Sunday Riley. Sunday Riley is available at Sephora and Sephora.com. If you were to look in my fridge right now, beneath the shelf of Topo Chico, you would find cases of Can. These are my currently in rotation batch, as I keep party packs stowed away as well. So what is Can? Can is a social tonic microdosed with cannabis that gives you a light and uplifted buzz, but with no hangover, fewer empty calories, all natural ingredients, and no regrets. Best of all, it tastes fucking good. So sure, I drink it for the THC CBD effects, but I also just enjoy it as a refreshment du jour. Blood orange cardamom is my favorite, but the grapefruit rosemary also slaps. For more information, including where to find it at your local dispensary and delivery options, follow at drinkcan with two N's or head to drinkcan.com. That's drinkcann.com. And we are back.
I have a bit of an esoteric question, but I'm wondering, why do you do what you do? We know what you do and how well you do, but I'd love to learn more about why you do.
I do it because I love the connections it creates. I love the idea of being able to tell stories of people that I haven't met before or I want to get to know. And it brings me closer to people I might not understand. When it comes to music, I love the idea of being able to express myself in the most honest way I know how. And it really does bring me joy. It really makes me happy. Like, this is, I can imagine myself doing other things, but I don't know that they would make me as happy as this. That's why.
Yeah. And speaking of your music, you know, we've seen you perform in so many roles and heard you on cast albums, but you also make your own music. And I'm wondering what it's like, the difference in process or even being in the studio when you're in the studio and you're singing as you, and these emotions are coming through you and not filtered through a character.
Creating my own music is far less removed than it is when I'm doing someone else's music. You know, when you're singing in a studio, you don't have to be there from its inception. So, you know, you begin and you're in a room. It could take anything from 3 hours to an entire day or a week to create something that is mine. And then I have to go in and then I'll do the vocal and I might not like that vocal and I have to go back in and I'll re-record it. And I'm in there every step of the way. Whereas if it's a cast album, I didn't have to write the song. I didn't pick the melody. I didn't do any of that. And I'm simply the conduit through which the music comes through, which is wonderful. But I think that the ability to connect to something more on a more personal level is the biggest difference. Yeah. When it comes to creating music.
I just have to tell you, when my dad was in the hospital awaiting his transplant, I surprised my parents and came home and visited, and playing in the hospital room was your album on repeat.
Are you joking?
No. And I couldn't believe that my dad, who I don't think my dad's someone who regularly listens to any music outside of like the band Chicago, literally that's and Styx, STYX, Styx. And he had your album on repeat. And so when you messaged me after I'd shared the story about my dad, I sent him the screenshot of your message and I was like, how appropriate. I know.
My mind is blown.
Yeah.
How did he, like, he just, it was just.
He found your music. That's the joy of your music. It's yeah.
That is so wonderful. Yeah,
but it was really moving.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm like blown away. That's like I'm floored. I can't even, that's crazy.
But isn't that the wonderful thing about, you know, creating this music per se, again, as opposed to just doing a theatrical album, is that you're telling stories that are reaching these new audiences and really touching people. And it's just, it's an incredible thing. And it's just, you know, going into the hospital, which is not a great place to be for anyone that's been there, and getting to hear something that is bringing someone you love such joy. It's a really magical thing. And that's one of the great gifts that you give to so many.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you very much. And that is also why I do it. The idea that your dad and I are connected because I made this album and he is enjoying that music. And those are stories from my life. Like it's amazing.
Absolutely. And to add to that, it becomes a story of our life, my dad and I. So it's like, that's the great thing, is it just keeps building and building and building. That's the power of music and art in general. Now, you never had a coming out per se, but in an August 2021 Evening Standard profile, when asked about your song, The Good, you confirmed that though the song, which is about the love between two Black women, is not necessarily autobiographical, you yourself do identify as queer. I want to zoom in on your follow-up quote. You added, "I don't think anyone thinks of me as a person that has relationships that aren't platonic. So I've never needed to even really discuss anything about my sexuality at all." And I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind unpacking that a bit, because I think there's a lot of there.
Yeah, I think, and I don't know if I'm the only person who's experienced that. I think a lot of people I don't think people think of Black women as people who have sexuality at all. They're either hypersexualized or asexual. And there's nothing in between, which is sort of, I think, where I landed on the side where she's a nice lady who's very good to people, then we don't think of her as a person who has relationships other than friendship. Because people just never ask. And I think maybe it could be out of respect. It could be out of, I don't know, it could be out of not even thinking about it. But yeah, that's sort of how I've felt for a long time. So I've never really even had to discuss it because no one's ever thought of it.
Well, if you wouldn't mind me asking, and feel free to curb me here, but I'm wondering if you can talk about you know, discovering your sexuality, coming into it, and if you had a coming out per se. I'd love to learn a little bit more about sort of like your journey through your sexuality.
Yeah, I've never had a coming out per se, and I don't know that I've just sort of lived as who I am. I see myself as queer, bi specifically. I don't know, I just never saw it as anything other than who I am. It's just never been like, it's not been a big deal for me.
Yeah, no, I get it. What do you make of coming outs in general? Because I mean, specifically in Hollywood, I think within the queer community, you know this, there's a lot of sort of like debate about the importance of the coming out. Because on the one hand, we live in a world which is largely cisgender and heterosexual. So the more representation, it's often, you know, seen as the better. However, as you're kind of saying, for so many queer people, I think especially modern queer people, queerness is so intrinsic to who we are that I don't think we often feel the need to siphon that aspect of ourselves off enough to make some sort of like announcement. And so there's kind of this duality to it of like, it is important. And yet by making it important, I think it can be a little reductive, but I also understand that there are people out there that it's meaningful.
It's such a tough one because no cisgendered heterosexual person has to have a coming out anything. They just are who they are. And I think that it's different from everyone. And I think that for some people, it's really important to proclaim. And I think that's what it is. I think if we can get to a place where coming out isn't necessarily for other people's benefit, that it's actually for the individual's benefit. If they need it, it is to proclaim that this is who they are so that they themselves can grasp ownership of that, as opposed to someone else or anyone else whispering about it, sort of guessing about it, making comments about it. If a person needs to proclaim and to claim ownership over who they are, then a coming out might be necessary. But then there are others who just are who they are and they want to move through the world in whatever person they want to be. And so maybe your coming out isn't necessarily needed. I think if we make room for both of those scenarios, we stand to be okay. Like, I think the expectation that someone has to come out should go away. It's the expectation, I think, that makes it difficult. When there is no expectation that a person can do as they want to, that as it suits them, then I think we might be moving in the right direction.
Very well said. And one more point on all of this, just going back to the original quote, I want to know, when do you feel the sexiest?
Ooh, when do I feel the sexiest? Strangely enough, I actually feel really sexy when I'm working out. I feel very sexy when I'm working out. I pick my outfit to work out. You know, I when I'm running in the middle, like I'm the girl that doesn't mind running in short shorts and like that. And I want to feel good when I'm outside when I'm running. So I feel very, very sexy when I'm running. But I feel sexy a lot of the time. Like when I'm performing, I feel really, really good. And when I'm, you know, there was a performance I did at the Disney Hall with Gustavo Dudamel, and he was conducting. And I just was like, I wore this sort of twisted top crop thing and so like jewelry. There was a bra underneath the twisted top, so nipples were pointing out, and it was just like belly was on show, and there was like a big skirt. I just felt really sexy that day, and I'm like singing Nina Simone, and it all felt really good. So yeah, it just depends. I might pick something I wear might make me feel really sexy, or I don't know, a piece that I'm listening to might make me feel. It just depends on the day. Definitely when I'm working out.
Shout out to that fabulous Versace dress you wore after to the Tony after party after you won your Tony Award. Just because if we're talking about Cynthia Erivo's sexiest moments, I feel like that has to rank highly.
Definitely, I definitely felt. That's for sure. On that, yeah.
As you should. A couple last questions. Tell me, of all of the great singers that you've been afforded the opportunity to sing with, which of them, and again, I'm not saying this is the definitive one. I know I'm asking you on the spot here, but is there one that comes to mind that was particularly meaningful to be able to share a stage with?
I think, ooh.
Yeah, you've had quite a few.
Because each of them had really special moments. Okay, so obviously this Shoshana, we had our Christmas concert. That was really beautiful to be able to share the stage with each other and to sing that way. Very, very, very special. And that was one of the defining moments when it comes to duetting. There aren't many people, I don't pick a person to duet with randomly, you know, and that was really, really cool to be able to share stage with her. Jennifer Holliday was really, we had our last performance. It was the last show. I don't know, there was something about that particular moment on stage that just felt electric. I don't know what it was about that performance, about that those moments where we got to sing together. It just felt really special. She was incredible. She was really incredible. And she, I don't know, I just, that day, I guess I didn't understand how much the show had meant to her until that moment. I knew it meant a lot to her, but I just knew that it meant, it was an extremely important moment for her on that last show. And I just, it just was wonderful to witness her do what she does. Yeah.
I love that. And I do want to shout out your duet with Shoshana that you guys did. You did a cover of When You Believe, the Stephen Schwartz song from The Prince of Egypt. It's on YouTube right now. It was part of a Seder of some kind, right? A virtual mm-hmm. Seder. Yep. Oh my God, your voices together. I mean, run, don't walk. Okay, couple last things. We know you are an avid runner. When you're not being the fabulous multi-hyphenate that we know and love you for, what are your hobbies and pastimes?
I used to knit a lot and I have to go back to that, but I love knitting. Pastimes, I actually like to cook. I don't have very much time to do it often, but when I do, I really like enjoy it. I love that. And obviously I have two dogs who I love very much. So spending time with them is a really cool pastime. And reading right now, like I love to read, but I've sort of like dived into reading a lot. So I'm trying to get a book every month, if not two.
Say you have guests coming over for a dinner and you're cooking, what are you making?
I am making, hopefully, we'll make two alternatives because if there's a vegetarian or a vegan person coming to dinner, then we'll make something that feels good for them. And maybe we'll do like, I think there's a way to do a really cool like vegetarian quiche or something like that, which is really, it's like a good crumbly pastry. It's a fish dish for someone. It's like it's essentially like fish that's lightly battered and then you cook it in butter. There's a name for it, but it escapes me now, but I did that. And I can make you any cake you want, pretty much. So
love. You will be portraying the Blue Fairy in the live action film adaptation of Pinocchio opposite Tom Hanks as Geppetto. As if your schedule was not booked and busy enough, is there anything you can tease us about this project?
Only that I think it's really, really fun and sweet and special, and I really enjoyed doing it. It was probably the most pleasant, easy job I've ever had to do because I wasn't there for very long to film it, and I'm singing live, and I loved doing it. It just is really cool. A lot of it is motion capture, I think, and but some of it is live action, so it's like a combination, lovely combination of both things, yeah.
I love it. We are so excited for that. My last question for you. When you look at this remarkable trajectory that your life has taken you on thus far, because there's a lot more life left to live for you and a lot more work in you. When you look back on this, I'm just wondering what young Cynthia would make of this stratosphere of success. And I say stratosphere because I feel like you just keep expanding on the limitations that people put on others is like, oh, you're an actress or you're a songwriter or you do theater or whatnot. And I feel like you are constantly permeating all of these spaces. And again, I said multi-hyphenate earlier, and that's really what you are. I'm just wondering what young Cynthia would say to all of this success.
I think young Cynthia would be really, really excited at what is happening. I think that we've sort of surpassed her wildest dreams. There was a dream that she had, and I think we sort of like levitated above that. And I think she'd be running around in circles, very, very pleased with what's going on, and extremely, extremely happy that she turns into me. And I think she might be quite excited about it. Yeah, very proud, I think. Yeah,
That's lovely to hear. I want to thank you again for your time, having a guest of your esteem. The value of that is not lost on me. And I just want to underline the fact that you are so incredible, both as a performer and as a human being. In the limited interactions I've had with you, I know this to be the case. And so I just want to thank you.
Thank you. And I'm very much enjoying this Christopher John Rogers moment. I love it.
You get it.
Of course I get it.
Shut up, Evan. Shut up, Evan. Shut up, Evan. Shut up, Evan. Shut up, Evan.
Shut Up, Evan is hosted by me, Evan Ross Katz, and produced by Ryan Killian Krause with distribution via Acast. Special shout out to Alden Peters, Matt Storm, Sean Ross, Hank Kelly, and the myriad others who have contributed their talents, past or present. For more Shut Up, Evan, binge seasons 1 and 2, and become a subscriber on Patreon for bonus episodes, never-before-seen clips, and more.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.